Greetings to all for another version of the Milt Rosenberg podcast. And as I've taken to saying, it is not a matter of accident that this is Milt Rosenberg speaking. Speaking to three old friends, two members of our regular old A-team, and a third who was increasingly and frequently a guest on our program at WGN. That third is David Lundy, who in the parlance of political television these days would be called a Democratic strategist, just as Chris Roebling would be called a Republican strategist. What strategist means is that these are people who do public relations, who do serious counsel and advice, who often design campaigns for elections and campaigns for important issues coming up legislatively, et cetera, et cetera. Our third guest, Charles Lipson, who is professor of political science at the University of Chicago, where he's also been chairman of that department in his time, the author of many important works. Perhaps the best known in his discipline is Reliable Partners, How Democracies Have Made a Separate Peace. Undergraduate at Yale, all his graduate degrees from Harvard, chairman of the University of Chicago Committee on International Relations. Those are the credentials, quickly, though hardly doing full justice to these three distinguished guests. This date, I must say, for our listeners, is Friday, August 1st. It's just turned 1 o'clock in Chicago on Friday, August 1st. And it's important to specify that because we're going to start in this general go-around on international relations issues, of which there are plenty these days, but we're going to start with the Middle East, that is, with Israel, Gaza, and all that pertains thereunto. And this very morning, there began the 72-hour, truce, peace, pause in the hostilities. It lasted for a full 2 hours. And apparently Gaza regulars, Gaza military, penetrated through one of their tunnels and killed two Israeli soldiers and captured a third. And Israel has responded this very day with very intensive bombing, particularly on the southern side of the Gaza Strip. That's just by way of quick summary. Charles Lipson, what do we make of all of this?
When I saw the ceasefire proposal that had been accepted, which was just a humanitarian ceasefire and far shorter in its intention than what John Kerry had been hoping for, a one-week ceasefire, I noticed that the Hamas leadership couldn't even bring itself to say the word Israel. It just talked about our opponent.
Well, they have never acknowledged the existence of a state called Israel.
And I think that what you have here is that in a larger sense, both of my colleagues are strategists, and strategy is very important here. I think that for the basic issue that was facing Israel was, could they deter Hamas and over time use that deterrence to build some kind of a workable relationship? They were not able to do that. Hamas repeatedly fired missiles in. Israel goes in and, in fact, starts to take out those and the tunnels. And at any point, Hamas could have yelled uncle and, in effect, said that we were deterred. They didn't. And I think what Israel decided it had to do was take out the capacity to destroy Israel, or at least keep southern Israel in terror. The next big issue then becomes, does Israel want to really take out all the Hamas leadership and all their infrastructure? That's a long, tough problem.
Now, let me raise some other issues. And let me start with a quotation familiar to anybody who is a Savoyard, who enjoys Gilbert and Sullivan. A buttercup sings in the Mikado, "Things are seldom what they seem. Skimmed milk masquerades as cream, etc., etc." Surely in international relations, for that matter, even in domestic politics, things are seldom merely what they seem. Thus, with regard to all of this and with regard to the intentions of Hamas in Gaza, must one not instantly ask and probe on this simple question? What are the interests behind Hamas? What is Iran's role? Who else in the Middle East has a, or in the world, has a significant role. And since we're talking now about Muslim nations, how does one also explain the standoff, the apparent neutrality, at least, of Egypt, of the Emirates, except for Qatar, and Jordan, and so on? What's the larger picture in the Middle East? Dave Lundy.
Well, I think there's some interesting things going on here. Obviously, this Hamas and Hezbollah were both Iran creations. They're proxies for Iran. In many respects, Iran has tried out techniques in Hezbollah that they've then imported to Hamas and vice versa. And most of the weapons are coming from Iran or through Iran.
And some from North Korea.
I was about apparently. To say, some through Iran from North Korea. So you have the larger question about Iranian nuclear intentions is always in the background for Israel. That's the existential threat. That's always been the existential threat. But when it comes to what's going on with Hamas, it was really interesting. I was watching CNN this morning, which is often frustrating for somebody who supports Israel. But the anchor was asking the question of a Hamas or a Palestinian spokesman said, well, surely the Hamas knew that this is the red line for Israel. If you kidnap one of their soldiers, they are going to ratchet up the violence and the hostilities in ways you have not yet seen, as bad as you think it is. So if they knew you were going to make life so unpleasant for the citizens of Gaza, why did Hamas do that? And therein lies, you know, one of the fundamental dilemmas, which is that Hamas does not have the protection of their civilian population.
What was the answer?
Oh, the answer was a deflection. It was just a saying, well, this is really all about Israel and Israel's fault and so on.
There is another possible answer. Let us not assume necessarily that command and control over troops and over your regulars and irregulars is fully guaranteed on the side of Hamas, possibly not even on the Israeli side. This whole fracas, it's far more than a fracas, began with the kidnapping and then murder of three young Israeli students. Mm-hmm. One of them, I think, American mm-hmm. and Israeli in joint citizenship. Was that kidnapping part of high Hamas policy? Was it planned in central Hamas councils, or was it an aberrant act by some very excited people on the border?
Well, I guess it appears now that notwithstanding statements by Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, sort of a month or so ago, that it appeared to him and to the government of Israel to be Hamas generated, it may in fact have turned out to be, as you say, an aberrant act, few bad actors out doing bad things, and then they got considerably worse, and three beautiful young people lost their lives.
Surely the murder only a day or two later of an Israeli Arab, which further aroused things,
incited,
would have been a, quote, spontaneous, though dreadful, act.
Yes, and
rather than Israeli policy.
Well, I agree. I want to get back, though. This is an extraordinary moment, if I may, Milt. This is an extraordinary moment. You asked about the community of Arab states and mm-hmm. how are they viewing this and where are they? And this is a unique moment when many very serious, very credible, one would say moderate governments are clearly not in support of what Hamas is doing. And they rather support what Israel is doing. And they're, I think, unfortunately, and Charles is the expert on this, but they're being overflown or driven by the American administration. So specifically, Egypt is absolutely furious with Hamas. Jordan, no surprise, Saudi Arabia, and I think maybe even some, as you pointed out, of the Emirates. Okay, not Qatar, but the others. And so you have a different balance going on right now. And unfortunately, and this is, we're missing an opportunity here, but the United States has chosen not to align with those traditional friends who happen in this case to be on the same side As Israel, which is our closest friend in the area, we are on the side of Turkey and Qatar and Secretary Kerry's efforts at a lengthy ceasefire seem to be emanating from a desire to keep some element of Hamas ticking. Okay, whereas I think the Israelis are moving to, even though Charles rightly says it's going to be difficult in the extreme, I think the Israelis are moving to a position of Hamas must be extirpated.
What is to account then for, and we should turn to it immediately, the American way of playing a role in this flare-up? Is it, to give the minimal interpretation or the most pragmatic one, is it simply a concern with international publicity and international reputation brought on by the heavy bombing in Gaza, which has killed by now over, how many civilians?
1,500.
1,500 is what they're claiming. Most recently, just a day or two before we are talking, the bombing of a UN-based school in which lots and lots of kids were quartered as refugees within their own community, so to speak. Are Kerry and are Obama simply playing to international public opinion? Because we do know that international public opinion has activated old, shall we call them, anti-Semitic engrams, and they're now elevated into riots, not only in some surrounding Arab capitals, but in Paris, anti-Semitic riots. Or is there a murkier or a deeper or a more tricky Machiavellian or for that matter, Chateaubriandish purpose to American foreign policy towards Israel and Gaza at the moment? Charles Lipson.
Thanks, Milt. It seems to me that the administration doesn't have any larger strategy on virtually any of its foreign policy. And I don't think it has a larger strategy here. I think it thought that if it could achieve a ceasefire, that would be desirable. It would increase America's reputation. It could show that it can deliver on its longtime friend and ally, Israel, and therefore be a major player and so forth. But in fact, I think that what's missing in the administration, besides an overarching strategy in foreign policy after its initial strategy of kind of friendly outreach to adversaries and more of multilateralism, really failed to achieve anything very positive with regard to traditional to adversaries that had been emerging during the Bush administration and so forth, Russia, for example, Iran. I think what you've had is a kind of flailing around. What you really need in foreign policy is a very clear framework guided by a kind of broad overarching strategy. And you need competent negotiators. And I've never felt like the Obama administration on the domestic or the international side provided real competence in negotiation. On the domestic side, I do think they have a clear framework. But internationally, I think that their framework collapsed and they don't really know what to do. But on negotiation, I think you can look back through President Obama's entire career and find virtually no important negotiations in which there was an adversary on the other side that where they reached an agreement in the way that Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan did. So I don't see any deep strategy here. The mistake they made tactically, Milton, was that instead of reaching out initially to the Egyptians and the Israelis and understanding exactly what the bottom line was, they undercut them by reaching out to the Qataris and the Turks. And remember, the Turkey's president, Erdogan, has actually said that what Israel has done is worse than the Nazis. The Hamas is being funded by Qatar. So when you reach out to them, you not only undercut Egypt and Israel, but you suggest to Hamas that if they can just stay in long enough, you might be able to flip America.
A call for a sidebar at this moment. Let me turn to Dave Lundy on this. Is John Kerry, formerly presidential candidate for the party with it you have more or less been affiliated for some time, is John Kerry sort of all thumbs as Secretary of State? Does he have the proper preparation? Does he have the proper orientation? Or is he really cumbersome?
Well, let me put it this way, because I've never been a fan of John Kerry. I was not a supporter of John Kerry. I find it interesting that those who wanted John Kerry as Secretary of State were those who were driving Susan Rice out. All the Republicans, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, they were the ones who were all saying, you know, why are you pushing this woman, Susan Rice, for Secretary of State when she said what she said about Benghazi, when you have a fabulous candidate here in John Kerry? Fundamentally,
Chairman of
John
the Senate
Kerry,
International Relations Committee.
Exactly. Fundamentally, John Kerry was nominated by John McCain and Lindsey Graham. So for the right to suddenly find themselves shocked that Kerry has negotiating difficulties, I find somewhat laughable. To me, it was pretty apparent from the get-go. That having been said, I think that John Kerry has been a little clumsy. He's done some things that aren't particularly bright. On the other hand, there have actually been achievements. I point to, you know, we can argue about the failure to back Syrian rebels, moderate Syrian rebels. I will take one position on that. Chris and Charles will take a different one. But the chemical weapons are largely out of Syria. If they were not, they could be used in a different way. I'm sorry, Chris. There are certain facts here.
I mean, I think you're contradicting the New York Times, and so good luck with that. The truth is, the chemical weapons that were identified by Syria are out of Syria, and everybody who is close to it, I think, David, you would have to acknowledge, has also said that Syria didn't identify all of the chemical weapons. And that's not even talking about other chemical weapons that may be in there. But
it was
look,
an achievement. Kerry had an achievement.
Right.
And
I think it was an accidental.
Right,
it was an accidental achievement, because remember how it got introduced.
Well, and it was against Kerry's own announced policy. I mean, Kerry was on a Friday, much like today, 1 year ago, was announcing we're going to essentially start bombing in Syria. And that was at noon on a Friday. And by about 4:30 or 5, we had U-turned. I want to say I think Kerry is... I've never thought he was the most elegant actor on any stage, but I think he also is carrying a very difficult and problematic policy that comes from his president. I think that Kerry has to do what Obama wants, and I think the center of this administration is not on foreign policy is not John Kerry. It's Valerie Jarrett. And it is Susan Rice, and it's Barack Obama, and I would say the two other elements on the fringes of that would be Samantha Power and Michelle Obama.
Samantha Power has actually put forward very strong and clear humanitarian statements at the UN. She's actually acquitted herself well during this.
I think Susan Rice.
That's right.
Susan Rice gave a speech this past week to the NJDC, the National Jewish Democratic Committee, which you could not find a more pro-Israel, strong anti-Hamas. It was a phenomenal
statement. But she's a real policymaker, and what we don't know is behind the scenes whether she was opposed to or strongly supportive of engaging Qatar and Turkey and so forth.
I just want to say, some of this we won't know for years or perhaps even for decades, and it'll come out in the histories eventually. But I want to say that personally, I felt this way before, but now I am confirmed in the belief nothing good will come of dealing with folks who are determined to destroy the other party in the conversation. And I think that there has been an ongoing international diplomatic assumption of what we might refer to as a legal fiction. And the legal fiction in this particular case is you can make a deal with these guys and you can make a deal to make a deal and things will get better and then you'll be able to make the deal. That what we really learn here is nothing good will ever come from dealing with Hamas.
Hamas or dealing with yet other Muslim, Arab nations and or strong organizations. For example, let me remind you, since we've made some reference to Syria, of the emergence of yet a new international player. It's the acronym now is ISIS, that which stands for
Islamic State in Iraq and Syria.
Yeah. And we know that those are Sunni militants. And according to some articles that I've been reading recently, they are not the only ones who've now grabbed about a third of Iraq. In fact, there are five or six other Sunni militant organizations who have a similar hand in all of this. And the populations of some of those northern Iraqi cities, Mosul particularly, have welcomed rather than resisted.
There are both ethnic and religious layers to the current chaos.
Exactly.
And
well, I'm glad you used just the word chaos. Is the Middle East, after 40 or 50 years of this sort of thing, clearly so permanently chaotic that, in fact, Israel's hopes for eventual stabilization and quietude between it and its neighbors can never be realized in our epoch?
Go ahead, David.
Sorry. You know, 25 years ago, I was a student in a study law abroad program at Tel Aviv University. This was the summer of 1990, so it was 14 years ago, or 24 years ago.
In a desperate effort to create Jewish lawyers?
Yes, thank you. And it was the summer right before Saddam Hussein invaded Iraq. And I remember having these wonderful conversations with Israelis and Palestinians, and we were talking about what a permanent solution might look like, mm-hmm. what a permanent settlement to the conflict might look like. And everybody knew, you know, the basic parameters, and they're similar to the parameters that were put forth 10 years later in 2000. And yet none of us, because I asked the question at the time, I said, can you imagine, though, you don't, for those who were opposed to any solution, who were taking, frankly, somewhat of a Roebling type position of, you know, you can't settle, there's no settlement, there's no way, no how. I said, well, you can't really seriously think that 25 years from now you're going to be sitting here governing over by then 5 million Palestinians. And I mean, basically it was I'm stunned that here we are 25 years later in the exact same position, only we're worse. We're worse off.
Well, how do you account for it?
Well, I mean, you account for it by the fact that there's a level of intransigence with Islamic fundamentalism. Islamic fundamentalism is the enemy here. It is a belief that you are 100% right, and your position is going to must rule overwhelmingly over your opponent, and every Jew must be driven into the sea.
And that
is where Hamas comes from.
And has that Islamic fundamentalism, putting Hamas aside for the moment, right, has that Islamic fundamentalism generally spread, diffused, and increased in intensity in the Middle Eastern Muslim world?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Then the question is why?
Because everything else has also failed there. There have been secular regimes, but they were military oppressive regimes, and they were kleptocracies where everybody stole. Basically, everybody knows what the terms would be. Israel doesn't want to rule over an alien population in the West Bank. There are questions about how you draw the lines and so forth. But the problem is when you have a large group that wants to drive Israel into the sea, then you have a particular problem. You've either got to be able to deter them, or you have to be able to disarm them, which is a form of deterrence for future actions. The problem that you have is that any two-state solution would involve a state on the West Bank and in Gaza that wouldn't have the right to do some of the things that a lot of states do. Because normally any state can make an alliance that it wants. Look at what Venezuela was, a de facto ally of Iran. But if you had a de facto ally or a de jure ally of Iran able to ship in tanks and missiles and everything, you know, from here downtown Chicago to Evanston, away from the only international airport and the major population center. So that's unacceptable. So what you have to have is a state that would, in effect, be disarmed. It would run itself as a kind of Finland-type state. That's what Finland did during the Cold War.
Or take the worst case. Take the absolutely worst imaginable case. Yeah. I put this directly to Chris. Go forward 10 years and hypothetically, but I fear it may not be hypothetical at all. Iran has the nuclear weapon, has the missile power to transport major nuclear hydrogen bombs to Israel to wipe it out with two such thrusts in one afternoon. Would they do it?
Yes. I have no doubt that if Iran...
Knowing that there's a counterforce capability that Israel still has with its nuclear weapons.
Right. And whatever remains are the shards of the U.S. nuclear umbrella to protect Israel as well. I mean, we basically have... I mean, I think we're operating now on the theory that if they touch a hair on Israel's head, they will cease to exist. Iran.
But I don't agree with you, Chris. Okay. I don't agree.
Well, I know Hillary stepped back from that, but I think the practical reality is if 10 o'clock in the morning there's a mushroom cloud over Tel Aviv, I believe that the mullahs in Iran think that the United States will flatten Iran.
The United States won't. Israel will. But where I disagree, so on that I totally agree that Israel will strike back. And it won't just strike back a little bit. It will just wipe the country off the face of the map.
In old strategic vocabulary, would they in fact physically be able to retain their retaliatory capability for a second strike after a first strike obliterative assault?
Yes. And they have a number of ways of doing that. I can't say that with total confidence because I don't know the technical side of it, but I think so. It's worth noting that Hamas has been lobbing missiles at the Dimona nuclear complex. They would be perfectly happy to create a nuclear holocaust right now if they could, right? And that's all at Iran's urging, and Iran would like to give them more precise. But here's where I differ with Chris. I think that Iran, knowing that it's Israel that would strike back, not America, which would, for obvious reasons, be queasy about doing that, I think that they are quite unlikely to strike. On the other side is not that they will strike, but that there is some non-zero possibility that they will. And I think that the debate in Israel would be whether to do something preemptively, and that's going to be a big debate in the coming year.
I just want to say it's not negligibly non-zero. Whether it's Israeli response or U.S. response, I take the point. But Iran's the mullahs who are there today, you're asking us to look ahead 10 years. I don't see any emerging framework within which security for the states of the Middle East will be respected. I don't think we can say that based on what's happening today.
Well, if you will now allow it, I invoke Lenin's great question. What is to be done?
Well, let me just before getting to the great question, I have to just say I disagree for a couple of reasons with actually both Chris and Charles. I don't think the attack will come from Iran directly. Because if Iran tries to launch a missile, first of all, Iron Dome has demonstrated Israel's got some pretty effective anti-missile capabilities. They're only going to be investing more. The United States is only going to be investing more. And what happens if Iran launches a nuclear missile towards Tel Aviv? It's intercepted. So we now know it came from Iran. The threat is going to be from a proxy. And so what scares me, and what genuinely scares me and chills me to my bone, is ISIS. ISIS right now is in a war with Syria. They're in a war with Assad. They're in a war with Iraq. They're fighting each other. What happens when that ends? They got supposedly $400 million out of the bank in Mosul. They have potentially unlimited funds right now. They were put up by Saudi Arabia. I don't know if Saudi Arabia is still funding
them. Do you believe that they are beheading their way toward Baghdad?
I think obviously that's
they get there?
That's their intent. I don't know whether they
can
will
they
get there or not. I mean, look, the United States invested an awful lot of money in the Iraqi army, and while they may have turned and run initially, I get the sense that maybe at this point they've realized they have an existential threat. And if
but ISIS has also got a lot of that American equipment.
No, that's true. So, but my point is this, that when it comes to Israel and the nuclear threat to Israel, what scares me is that ISIS will have a capability to bring a nuke in some way that is not as traceable as a missile. I've always found the missile threat to be the most absurd threat because it was the most traceable threat. Whereas
this is the suitcase bomb scenario.
Yeah, the suitcase bomb or the truck bomb or some other way of getting it in. And in that case, when you can't put a finger on who actually push the nuclear button in Israel. That's where I think is a far more likely scenario, and it's a far scarier scenario because it's harder to defend.
There are some other scary aspects. I want to endorse what Dave said. It is a very scary scenario. There are a lot. Most people in my own field of international politics think it quite unlikely at this point that there would be any nuclear materials, certainly not a bomb, handed off by a nuclear power, and Iran has not become a nuclear power or nuclear capable power at this point. But I want to point to several other important things about ISIS. First thing is it's totally wiped out the old borders of the Middle East, the ones that were drawn in the aftermath of World War I when the Ottoman Empire split up so that you had a separate Iraq and Lebanon and Syria. Those borders are gone, and within them we're forming new borders with a lot of ethnic tensions surrounding them, in part because there are no clear borders. The fact is Sunni and Shia and Kurds sometimes overlap in different areas, and where they do overlap, there's tough fighting. Second thing is just as we were concerned about the Taliban, why do we care if they're fundamentalists that are ruling Afghanistan? We don't, except that they allowed Al-Qaeda to train there, and they knocked down buildings in New York City. We're going to be concerned about the same with ISIS. And the final point is that we are now seeing in both Syria and in Iraq people with passports from the United States, Britain, Germany, France, and the rest training as battle-hardened terrorist fighters, and they're going to be able to come back and do enormous damage at the Mall of America.
An alternative scenario on a lesser dimension, but because of the time difference between this real time at the moment, Friday, August 1st, and the time when this will be heard, which will be 3 or 4 days from now, it could be an embarrassment if 3 or 4 days from now the news will be, yes, after August 1st came August 2nd, and by that time in Cairo with Kerry present and representatives from Israel and from Gaza and from the rest of the Palestinian community, the PLO bunch, they settled it after all and apologized for the fracas on the border 2 hours after the beginning of the initiative for a holdback, and they are in fact proceeding to work it all out. Israel is yielding on the question of blocking.
Next year in Cairo,
shall we sing Kumbaya?
that is not going to happen.
Then our conversation of this moment would possibly be less relevant, or would it remain?
Bring us back in for a new podcast if that happens.
We could talk about the Ukraine,
or would it remain relevant, even if they do get a temporary fix on the Gaza thing?
Oh, I think we're seeing an unleashing. I mean, I think the historic significance of what Charles referred to a moment ago, the wiping out of these international community borders that were themselves a post-colonial in the sense of a post-Ottoman response. I mean, the colonial era over there was not the French in Syria and the British in Baghdad. The colonial era was the Ottoman era. And after World War I and the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, yes, there were protectorates and yes, there were different lines. The wiping out of those lines by ISIS or ISIL, which is Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, which I think is particularly annoying, but
even more ambitious in its aims.
Exactly. And I think a little more descriptive, therefore.
And they talk about it as a caliphate.
They talk about it as a caliphate. They now call themselves the caliphate. And this is a supreme, I would say, dislocation to the mullahs in Persia and in Iran, because they believe that their Shia Islam will be the global caliphate, and they're looking at these Sunnis in ISIS who are proclaiming their
own global
caliphate.
Look at the position it's left America in. One side is this ISIS or ISIL, which is this awful terrorist, sort of like Al-Qaeda, but Al-Qaeda considers them too violent, if you can imagine. And on the other side is who? Iran. So, my goodness, you've got Iran and Syria. So you've got, I mean, how did the United States manage in a country where we fought all this time to end up with those two as the alternatives?
Because we control the world.
My answer comes from a Zen koan in classic Buddhist practice in Japan. These are the riddles that they gave to Buddhist apprentices. The great question is, the duck is in the bottle. How do you get him out? And the answer, as you think about it for 20 years and keep giving answers which are rejected by the master, who usually hits you with a stick to let you know that you're on the wrong track. But finally, it dawns on a great potential bodhisattva. The duck is in the bottle. How do you get him out? Pause. There. It's out.
Yes.
I bring that up now to say that we're dealing with an insoluble problem, but maybe it will get solved. Meanwhile,
this is going to be a 7-year podcast, Milt,
no.
in which we say, and toward the end, my God, we solved it, Milt.
No, I'm trying to find a transition, and I was going to pick up on Chris's point that borders are no longer sacrosanct. Another border that is no longer sacrosanct is the border of the Ukraine. Or of Ukraine. You're not supposed to say the Ukraine anymore. And gentlemen, we're going to have to shift in that direction. The undertakings of the bunch around the president of the Russian Confederation is a little mysterious. Needs some discernment. Needs some translating in terms of what their policy intentions may be. And we'll get to that right now. So we come to another troubled part of the world, to be sure. And that trouble arose more recently. We remember that the Soviet Union was dissolved. Was it the year 89 or 90?
Well, at the very
end. It was in process by 89.
Well, the empire collapsed in 89 and Soviet Union in 91.
Yeah. And the separate Soviet Socialist Republics in the main took their independence, as did, of course, Ukraine, the largest of them.
And we guaranteed Ukraine its security.
Yeah. So what's happened since then, Charles Lipson? And why it looked stable for a while, even though there was internal political conflict in Ukraine. But now the old Soviets, so to speak, that is the men who were trained there, particularly the president of the Russian Federation, seem to want to get a good portion of Ukraine back. They got Crimea, and now they're after eastern Ukraine, apparently.
Well, two big things happened in the aftermath of the Soviet Union splitting apart and many of its constituent parts turning into independent states, which were initially recognized by Moscow. The first thing that happened was that many of the former states were incorporated into the Western framework, meaning that they joined NATO and they joined the European Union. Not all of them did, but a number of them did, key one being Poland, but also East Germany was integrated into Germany and so forth. The second thing that happened was that Russia's transition to a democracy essentially failed. And after it failed, you had a strong man come back in, Putin, whose goal wasn't as much, I think, to reestablish the Soviet Union as to reestablish the old Tsarist Empire, where he's reincorporating many of these areas. The problem that that created was too big. The biggest problem it created was that it potentially overturned the entire architecture of the post-Cold War relationship in Eastern Europe, and that had two flashpoints. The first was Georgia, the state of Georgia, the country of Georgia, and the Russians invaded and took part of that. During the Bush administration, there was no pushback. The second has been Ukraine, and then what happened in Ukraine was that Putin, in effect, set up a little Putin in Ukraine, and what's launched the latest firestorm has been that there was a popular revolt about 9 months ago or so that overturned that Soviet that Russian Soviet style dictator who looked a lot like Putin and who did carried Putin's water. When he did that, Putin not only realized he was losing Ukraine, but that if he didn't do something strong, the same thing could happen to him.
Of course,
so that's what's launched all of this. He took Crimea.
Well,
then.
Couldn't you possibly say that it was launched by the prior stage, namely that the Western-oriented Ukrainian leadership was trying to league with the West, both through NATO and through the European Union?
Just a final point on this. When I've talked, there was a big debate in the 1990s during the Clinton administration about whether NATO should actually make alliances in Eastern Europe. There were a number of people, this didn't split along ideological lines. There were a number of people who said, look, we need to give them reassurance. It won't threaten the Russians. It will set up a stable framework there. And to the extent that the Russians want to reassert their control over the area, we need to do this. The other people said, look, it's bound to threaten the Russians no matter what we say. And what I find interesting about the current situation, Milton, is that both sides think they were correct. That is, the people say, look at how Putin is behaving. Isn't it a good thing that we've offered these security guarantees and that they are stable in the Baltics and Poland and so forth? The other side says, no, look at how we threaten the Russians, and that's why they're pushing back. So both sides feel justified.
Was the shooting down of the Malaysian airliner essentially a matter of incompetence in the hands of the irregulars, the Russian-speaking Ukrainians, who have been armed by Russia, undoubtedly, and who are backed by Russia in a significant way, but who, to be sure...
I think, Milt, it is inevitable to conclude that while the Russians aided and abetted, this was incompetence by the separatists, who may be, to varying degrees, Russian and Ukrainian. They were playing with fire. They shouldn't have done so. I don't think that they intended to knock down a civilian commercial airliner, but that's what they did. And no one in Europe seems terribly upset about it. And that is a crying shame.
Oh, I think they're upset. I just don't think they're pushing back very much.
Hang on. You could have said that a week ago. But a lot of people said, myself included, that the shooting down of the airplane was a game changer. It took longer than I expected for Europe to finally get around to imposing sanctions and joining the Obama administration, but they did it. They finally did it this week. Have they imposed every sanction possible? No. Gazprom still is supplying natural gas, but that's partially and large measure because that's good for the Europeans. They don't want to cut off their nose to spite their face, and that's their big fear, is that they will cut off their natural gas supply and prices are going to go through the roof in Europe. So I think it's unfair, Chris, to say the Europeans were, you know, did not seem that upset about it. I think they were very upset about it. They felt helpless. Wasn't until the shooting down of the airline that they finally realized this is not going to end well, because Putin, in response, he had a choice. Putin could have said, you know, this is a horrible tragedy. You know, we really need to come to some resolution. You know, I will encourage the folks in the separatists to negotiate. Or he could basically say, thumb his nose at Europe, thumb his nose at the West, and say, oh, yeah, you have a problem with it. Well, let's see you do something about it. And that's what he chose to do.
I think what you see with Putin
is a
KGB guy trying to run an economy. And I think he's running it just like you would expect. And I think that what you're seeing now is the kind of chaos that he is inadvertently wrecking on that economy. What's made things gravy for him for so long is that when you're drawing up oil out of the ground, there's lots of money to give to your friends and to keep for yourself, so everybody becomes multi-billionaires, and you don't have to tax people, and you can pay off potential opponents. If the price of energy goes down, as it's likely to, or at least stay constant because of fracking and other things, Putin is actually in a very vulnerable position.
Just to complete my point, that is exactly why I say Europe isn't as energized, no pun intended, as I would like to see them. And it is simply this: Europe will send a message to Russia and to the world about its standards when it decides to exploit its own energy resources. As David points out, they are deeply concerned, and I think that everything they do towards Russia for now is tentative and hesitant. Just like you pointed out, they hesitated.
But there are good reasons. There are two reasons that I want to underscore, Chris. One is they have a very fragile economic situation. They could easily turn back into another recession. It's been a very slow recovery. And the second thing, I know David won't like to hear this, but who wants to go into a battle when Obama has your back? You need to have a very clear sense of what American policy is going to be over the long term and under pressure.
Okay.
If you've got,
I don't deny, look, I'm not to trash Obama, but the United States, relatively speaking, is a little harder to sort of pin down. Let's just put it that way and not get David jumping out of his chair. But I think the point that has to be made here is that Europe stood up 10 years ago and said, who speaks for Europe? The EU speaks for Europe. Let's have a foreign secretary in Brussels. And when the American president calls Europe, who will he call? And they all convinced themselves they were going to call the foreign. Well, everybody's forgotten who the foreign secretary is in Brussels. That's a complete joke. So I don't disagree with you, Charles.
Yeah.
But Europe is either, if we're going to have a multipolar, looser association of countries and a security framework to match that, then regions like Europe are going to have to stand up for themselves, especially when there is a belligerent actor in their region, as Putin now unquestionably is.
If you talk about Europe, you have to take into account the rather pessimistic views voiced by people like Mark Stein and, for that matter, even Robert Kagan. And that is that Europe is being transformed on a demographic basis.
I believe that's the reason about
Ukraine.
Transformed
by the presence of increasing emigration from essentially the Muslim world.
And I believe that is a big part of Putin's interest in the Ukraine, because the demographic decline of Europe is actually led by the demographic decline of Russia.
That's right.
And there are Russians aplenty in Ukraine. And I believe that is that Putin has a demographic.
There are also Russians aplenty in the Baltic states, in Belarus, and in Moldova.
Exactly.
And in Northbrook.
This is an important moment for Europe, because one of the things that's been most notable is that the demonstrations around Israel-Gaza, which we talked about earlier, have not just been anti-Israel. They've been openly anti-Semitic, joining the right and the left with all kinds of Muslims and especially extremists. This comes at a point when Europe can still make some decisions, but they need to be deeply troubled and think about what their future is, because this may be one of the last chances they have.
There's an interesting bulletin to add to that. It came only yesterday, a big public opinion poll in France on the coming, though it's a few years away, presidential election. And the winner in the poll was Marine Le Pen, the candidate of the National Front, which used to be an overtly anti-Semitic organization.
Well, it is deeply disturbing to watch what's gone on in Paris. Whenever you have these discussions with folks, and I have friends on the left who are not comfortable with Israel, and I get into these discussions, and you say this isn't about anti-Semitism, this is about anti-Israel, and I say, well, you know what, that's nonsense. First of all, I don't remember them. I said 700 people died in one day in Syria, one day last week in Syria. I don't see anti-Syrian protests.
Where was Gloria Steinem then?
Okay, Gloria Steinem's not my problem. In any event,
well, she was among the people last week who had a big pro-Hamas statement.
I think it was an anti-Israel statement. But
that's
in any event,
right.
My point is that when you see what's happening in Paris, they're not bombing the Israeli embassy. They're bombing Jewish institutions. They're calling
synagogue
for gassing Jews overtly,
they
out
have
loud.
Posters saying it.
It's stunning. It's so depressing. And by the way, this was not an unforeseen phenomenon. As immigration from Algeria and Morocco and other parts of Muslim North Africa moved into France, a lot of folks, myself included, said, I fear for what this is going to look like in the future, where France's position is going to be in the future. And the question, frankly, isn't so much today. The question is 10, 20 years from now.
By the way, incidentally, this is to all three of you, of course. Do you get any sense that anti-Semitism, on the basis of that same dynamic, is even inching up in this country?
Well, I think we see very troubling trends on American campuses. What I read about American campuses is very concerning, and I think that's a source of great unease. And I think that in general, we see culturally or socially in the United States a loss of a sense that Israel is a great friend of the United States. I believe that the perception of Israel among certain segments of society. David has already referred to his friends on the left, and it is. Let's be honest. It's very virulent on the left. So much so that, for instance, Hillary Clinton, who wants to be a Democratic presidential nominee, in my opinion, hedged some of her comments this week to allow for some appreciation of what the Palestinians, what Hamas are facing in Gaza. And I think that is, so you look at the left or some elements of the left and you look at the campuses, and I think and you look at society at large, it's disconcerting.
Chris, you're mixing two different issues. You're mixing the question of is there anti-Semitism, is there activism on the left, and there is genuine outrage, there is genuine frustration at the human carnage in Gaza. I feel it. I watch what's happening over there, and how can you not be pained by what's happening to women and children? Where I draw the distinction is I focus squarely on who is responsible for that carnage, and that carnage is Hamas's doing, period, full stop. But there are a lot of people, and you asked earlier, Milt, at the start of this show, why the Obama administration, what the motivation of the Obama administration was in pushing the ceasefire so hard. I think everybody is just dismissing out of hand the notion of President Obama, personally, John Kerry, and an awful lot of folks in the government are saying the carnage is awful and needs to stop. In and of itself, that is an objective. And so the question is the short-term objective, which is a short-term ceasefire, and a long-term objective, which is coming up with some accommodation to solve the problem.
Well, just remember, we got into Libya because we had a short-term objection to the possible killing of civilians. And we went in, and in the process, we created a situation that's led to many, many more deaths. So you have to be able to think more than one or two moves ahead, even if your goals are noble. The issue about anti-Semitism, it's rampant and rife within Europe, where there is an old, powerful tradition of anti-Semitism on the right that's now been adopted by the left and has been supplemented by this large North African immigration. There are parts of Sweden and Norway where Jews can't live. There's just, and by the way, and gays can't live. And there are parts of Amsterdam that women just can't walk in alone.
What happens to Jewish gays?
In the United States, there is no such rampant anti-Semitism except among some radical Muslims. But I would say the following. There has been a slow, strong shift to powerful and increasingly vocal anti-Israel attitudes on the left. The Democratic Party is now split, and what I would tell you is that the response to this, the best response to this, is that I think America needs to rethink what it means to be a liberal democracy in the world.
Gentlemen, the great problem running a program like this, in which you're doing a tour of the horizon, so to speak, is transition, because you can't complete any one of the topics. We've hit two main topics. I take you now to another geographical location, the border between the United States and Mexico.
That's our theme today, is borders disappearing.
Exactly. That, I suppose, unifies it all. I take you to Texas and New Mexico and Arizona and Southern California. What's going on? What has been going on over the last 2 or 3 years? And since the government has been in the hands of a potent Democratic administration, I must put that question first directly to David Lundy.
I think that there has been a question about, is the border secure, and what is happening with, in general, is the border secure?
Another related question is, and what is the American government really up to with regard to its tolerance, perhaps even its encouragement of extensive immigration, including now the onslaught, shall we call it, certainly the massive transfer of possibly ultimately a few million Latin American, whether Central American or Mexican, or Lord knows, maybe ultimately they'll come from Venezuela, young adolescents.
First of all, I'm not really worried about people walking from Venezuela to the southern.
Well, you can
border.
Ride.
It's a long way. That having been said, I think that there's a lot of hyperbole. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of jingoism going on right now, and has been. The reactionaries on the right in the Republican Party are so terrified of undocumented immigrants. They're so terrified of these children who are here on the border, you could argue under false pretenses, that they are incapable of any action whatsoever in the U.S. House, as was witnessed yesterday when John Boehner's own minimalist bill for a supplemental appropriation was withdrawn because Ted Cruz came and lobbied Republicans to vote against the bill. It's a weird thing going on in D.C. But the larger question is, number one, is the border secure? The answer is largely yes. The Obama administration has dramatically increased enforcement along the border. Net immigration from Mexico had achieved zero. Part of that was economic, but part of it was because the border was controlled. Number two, the children who are at the border right now, they are not in U.S. custody because they made their way through the border. They're in U.S. custody because they're walking to border stations and handing themselves in because that's what they've been told to do. by their parents and by the coyotes and the crazies, the gangs that are basically selling them a bill of goods.
They've been told that with encouragement or with opposition from the government of the United States.
Well, the darndest thing, Milt, is that there is a law. It's a 2008 law signed by George W. Bush that says that migrants, children from non-contiguous countries in Latin America are entitled to a hearing and due process. And with all due respect to Republicans in Congress right now who have said, just put them on a boat and throw them out, or as I forget which congressman said it, said it would cost $60 million to solve this problem, just give them all one-way air tickets back home. Well, I'm sorry, sir, but that's not the law. And sitting and listening yesterday to John Boehner attacking the White House for not taking executive action,
unilateral executive action,
when the day before they filed a lawsuit against President Obama for taking executive action. Get a grip. The Republican Party seriously needs to get a grip. I will tell you personally, I don't understand what the fear is. I don't understand what the fear is. Even George Will said, you're telling me that we cannot absorb refugees? These children, and I don't know which are...
He wants to put 20 in every county in the United States. There's just such a carousel.
That was just a bad math problem.
There was just a carousel of errors in what you said, David.
Oh, a carousel of errors.
A carousel of errors. I see the beautiful painted horses going around, each with one of your little errors on it. there are people, of course, with xenophobic and anti-foreign attitudes. I think that I don't want to deny that there are some people who have that, but there are a lot of people who think that every country has a right to secure its own border. We were just talking about this with regard to Europe, and now we're talking about it here. The law that Bush signed had an unintended consequence. It was designed to prevent sex trafficking and referring to very small numbers of children. When it became clear that after President Obama said, we're never sending little children back, don't get me wrong, and then they began all sending, well, they, in effect, he held out the prospect that they would never be sent back, and of course, they read that correctly as, come all ye faithful, and they did. Then people said, okay, this was not what the law was intended to. All we need to do is just correct the law. Obama said, yes, that's correct. We'll just correct the law so that we can still deal with the sex trafficking, but these children who come in large numbers, we can send them back. Then he got pressure from Mexican Americans and the left, and he flipped. So now we can't solve anything. The idea that we have secured the border, which is what you said, is I think, quite wrong. I don't think the border's secure.
Before you get in on it, let me just say, I did put the question first. The basic question of what's going on, what's been going on in recent years with regard to immigration, what has been the real purpose, and is it a disguised purpose of the American government? I put that to David Lundy as, using the lexicon of television news, a Democratic strategist. I do want to now put it to a Republican strategist and get a full response from Chris Roebling.
Well, I don't know how Republican I'm going to sound, but I do want to say I agree that the law was signed by George Bush and it was passed by a Democrat Congress, and it dealt with an important issue because we as Americans care about underage kids, underage people who show up and are possibly the victims of sex trafficking. So that is a noble effort on everybody's part. And furthermore, I agree that once President Obama got into office, and David, you're not going to like hearing it, but and I'm not going to dispute you much about the Republicans in Congress right now. I'm going to say that people like President Obama and his administration have to watch what they are saying, whether they're proclaiming a red line in Syria or if they're talking about issues related to immigration such that we might see a flood of immigrants. Now, that is very significantly water under the public discussion bridge.
As Sam Goldwyn once said, we've all passed a lot of water since then.
And we are looking at something on the – and we're looking at a very serious concern. Now, I personally – I don't have any problem thinking that we can absorb 60 or 70,000 kids. On the other hand, the fact is at this point, we don't know exactly what we're dealing with. And there are issues of public health. There are issues of criminality. There are issues of gang infiltration. There are a lot of things going on down there that are – that our network of resources have not been – in my opinion, appropriately deployed to screen.
Why can't
you
Mexico
mentioned 60 or 70,000. Some have said that the ultimate intention or the ultimate likelihood, if we go this path, is as much as 5 million Latin Americans under the age of 21.
And I think that is that's why President Obama was right when he said, let's change the law so that we're distinguishing between the child victims of sex trafficking, on the one hand, and these mass migratory movements on the other hand.
But he was for it before he was against
it. But even before we talked about sex trafficking, there is a fundamental question about refugee status. Okay. There's a question about.
No, there is not.
There's not a question about refugees. No,
because refugees.
None of these kids would qualify as refugees?
Almost none of them. And the reason that you don't hear even La Raza and any of those talking about it is that the term refugee has a very clear meaning. And unless they absolutely change the definition of refugee so that it includes escaping from bad civil situations and poverty and gang warfare and so forth, then these are not refugees. They really aren't. There's a definition of refugee.
There's a definition, and I want to emphasize that to make these kids refugees, in some serious sense, empties the meaning of refugee and means that everybody who is
in a
depressed country becomes a refugee.
There would be billions of refugees.
That's not workable either.
Basic question, why in this conversation on this important topic has no one yet made any reference to the likely political consequences of a large established inundation of young Latin Americans?
There is
to the fortunes of the future Democratic
Party. There's certainly no short-term
political
consequences because these people would all have to become citizens. Mm-hmm. And in order to become citizens, first they have
and
to become
up.
Legal. And they'd have to grow up. You're talking about a potential impact, 15, 20 years down the road.
But that's not the issue politically, David. The issue politically, you're quite right. David's absolutely right about this. But this is a wedge issue between the parties. Wouldn't you agree, David? In other words, what happens here, it has two effects. One is that it allows the Democrats to position themselves as pro-Hispanic and allows them easily to position the Republicans both as anti-Hispanic and as a do-nothing Congress. And then
it's a strong play for the present Latin American
And then the
vote.
Second thing is it's a shiny object that distracts from all the other things that are going wrong.
Please. The bipartisan, the immigration reform bill passed the United States Senate with, I believe, 15 Republican votes. Okay? This was not some radical piece of legislation. The fact is that Republicans, national Republicans, non-Tea Party Republicans recognize that the wedge is not being drawn by the Democrats. The wedge is being drawn by Republicans who are insisting not recognizing the legitimate
opportunity. I agree with that there's a lot of that, and Obama's exploiting it.
Well,
don't you think?
Sure. Why wouldn't he?
As the Republican around here, I want to say, I wish that what David said—
You're the only one around here?
I wish that what David had said— about these folks, before they vote, they have to become citizens. I know we're limited in our topics. If anybody in the sound of my voice thinks that only citizens vote in the United States of America, then I, as a Roebling, have a bridge that runs from Brooklyn to Manhattan that I want to sell to
Didn't
you.
The Roeblings build that bridge?
I want to tell you
Chris
that
is a direct descendant.
If you are I'm not a direct descendant, but if you are ready to believe that only citizens vote in the United States of America in 2014 or in 2012 or 2008, then good luck with that.
And if
you're
going to
be disappointed
that large numbers of non-citizens vote, I would like to see the statistics on that. actual, I would like to see the lawsuits on that. I would like to see the Department of Justice, Republican or Democrat Department of Justice, who've made a huge issue over non-citizen voting. You know what? I can't see that because it's a fantasy.
I want to raise two issues here. One is that I think that part of the difficulty in getting a deal on any of this is not just the split within the Republican Party, which is deep and profound, but the feeling that no matter what you pass as a law, President Obama will enforce whatever the heck he wants.
Oh, God. Are we starting a new program now?
No, and I think that's one thing. But there's a large, even larger issue. I think that there's a broad sense that things are simply wheeling out of control, that there's just, both in the world and in our country, there's no sense of stability.
I share that concern.
Let me close by reverting to what has been my profession over the long years, namely as a psychologist, indeed a social psychologist, interested as well in history. And I offer you the simple observation, tell me if I'm wrong, that in all of human history, we find instability. We find that collectivities, as large as nations or tribes or what have you, tend to define themselves in opposition to other collectivities, that that's what strengthens and maintains collectivity. Are we, in fact, caught these days, looking at the three problems we've examined, and we could have examined 10 others that are in the current news, are we, in fact, caught in a kind of eternal process, which is, in a way, the mark and the burden of that most intelligent of all species, the race of Homo sapiens?
Let me say that I think that we have seen a substantial rise of nationalism and tribalism around the world over the last decade or so. It's one of the themes that tied together the first two parts of this podcast, Milt, in the Middle East and in Ukraine, Russia, and so forth. There has been a substantial rise of that. We've seen this movie before. It generally doesn't have a good ending. The second part, though, is that's not been the case in the United States. We've had a lot of nationalism, but it's not been nationalism that's been largely opposed to others. What's different in the United States now, and I think this has been deliberately fostered by the left's view of the world, is a sense that we are not a melting pot, but we are a collection of victims, each little group of victims. And I see a lot of that around here, and I think it's deeply damaging to our sense of what it means to be an American.
Also sprach Charles Lipson, jetzt spricht Chris Roebling.
America is the answer. And here's what I mean by that. I think part of American exceptionalism was this proposition to the entire world that it didn't really matter where you came from, that you know, there were folks here and you could join. And if you adhered to this set of beliefs, if those were your beliefs,
the
and
American creed,
you then were, you had a ticket to of opportunity to as far as your talents could take you. And I think what we're seeing here, that was a great antidote to what you describe. And I think whatever the case might be domestically about, you know, critics of America, and God knows America deserves all the critics, you know, I mean, we've done things wrong, et cetera, et cetera. But internationally, we are seeing the world without a, in my opinion, clear and decisive American voice. And I regret that innocents are paying for it with their lives.
We've heard from two members of the old A team, Charles Lipson and Chris Roebling, in the last round. And the final word goes to David Lindy.
I think that when you look at the tribalism and the nationalism in the historical context, you have to go back to the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of a bilateral planet Earth. Fundamentally, in the entire post-World War II period, you had two camps. You were either pro-Russia, pro-Soviet or pro-U.S., or anti the other, in which case you were in that camp. Once the Berlin Wall, I remember at the time talking about this with friends, saying, well, this is really exciting, this is great, and we've just unleashed a whirlwind of nationalism that's going to sprout all around the world. So with respect to my friend Charles, this is not a problem of the last decade. This is a an absolute fundamental required outgrowth of the removal of the bilateral world. And when you remove the pressure of that and you also remove these dictators, you remove the Libyan dictator, you remove Saddam Hussein, what is bubbling up from underneath is this fundamentally disruptive nationalism that we don't know where that is going to take us. It is a scary time. It is an unstable time. It is an uncertain time. But it is not something that the United States alone can solve the problem. We're just taking a bunch of eggs, scrambling them, and we'll see what comes out.
Thank you so much to all three of you for an excellent and very provocative conversation.